thank you so much for being out here. I was just looking at how beautiful the sky was and with the bright green of the leaves. And anyway, this is pretty nice to be able to be out here on a Santa Barbara evening and speak outside. So I'm really grateful about that. This is the first time that I've ever done such a speech, and really probably the first time anybody in my family has ever talked about, I wanted to, in preparation for this, I went up and down and sideways to try to figure out what I was going to talk about. And I had a lot of anxiety this week. I really did. I won't lie. Trying to get forth the message. Anyway, it was just kind of messing with me, and I used a lot of procrastination and all these, self-defeating tools that all of us use. And so finally, yesterday, I wrote the thing out, and, oh my gosh. And, it is what it is, and, so many times the universe gives me exactly what I need. So I open up our Strengthening Our Recovery today, July 28th, and the topic is vulnerability. And if you don't mind, I'll read it to you. To withstand the intense pain of living with insanity and to have any sense of control, we must deny our feelings and hide our vulnerability. That's from the Big Red Book, page 356. As we grew up, we were shattered into many parts. Because of the insanity around us, we learned to hide our more vulnerable parts in order to survive. Some of us became multiple personalities, and others of us were less broken, but we all found ourselves numb in some way. We adapted and adopted whatever survival techniques we needed. In ACA recovery, it can take some time for some of our hidden parts to make themselves known. Until they trust, there is an inner loving parent who accepts them. We work with our recovery partners and discover how to give ourselves the warmth, love, compassion, and understanding we didn't experience as children. As we comfort and protect our inner child, we make healing our priority as we learn to quiet ourselves to see that feelings come up, what feelings come up, what memories surface. To help ensure that the rooms of recovery are available for ourselves and others, we can also begin to give service in our meetings in small ways. We see that our honesty can encourage others to face their own fears as we learn together how to experience balance in our lives. And then in italics, it says, on this day, I will listen to and comfort my inner child, accepting all the parts of myself that make me unique. I look forward to who I can become as I heal. So I thought that was really a nice kind of introduction to this tonight. Also, as I said so many times, I know that the universe has my back. In fact, that's the name of my journal. I really like this book. It's got all kinds of beautiful little line drawings in it, but enough space to write in. So that's like my third one that I've bought of these. But anyway, I also use, I like these cards. They're an oracle deck, and they're called My Soul Flower. And I have them sitting like on my vanity where I get ready in the morning and by my makeup mirror and stuff like that. And I usually pull one card out every day. And so this one that I pulled out today is, there's always a botanical illustration on there. The lady that does this is really into plants. And so this one was crocus. And the little affirmation is opening. Tender crocus is one of the first flowers to appear in the spring. She is gently reminding you to open to the beauty and softness of the world, even though it may seem harsh and inhospitable at times. trust in the process. Open and accept the possibility that there is love and magic surrounding you always. So I thought that was another tie-in with the vulnerability of you know, what we share together. So, and by the way, if anybody wants to pull a card, they're right here after, you know, feel free to. And they're really very pretty. Okay, so what I hope to accomplish today, or this evening, to learn better how to feel, to not be so scared of the outcome, to know it's okay to grieve my losses, and not get distracted from the process, to heal with continued hope. And to do this, I'll explore first what went wrong. I brought a picture of my parents. They were the instruments of my existence. This is Cecil and this is Levina. They were adult children, but they never sought treatment. So my story is, I was born in the Central Valley in the small town of Tulare. My parents were children in grown-up bodies. Creating the family history diagram was the most profound experience that, I really appreciate all of the things that I do in ACA, but that family history diagram, that was real big for me. I did several drafts before finishing one on large newsprint paper. Through it, I learned the roots of the dysfunction that had permeated both sides of my family. Because so many relatives are now deceased, I could not go back and ask the primary players, my parents, my brothers, my grandparents. So I had to dig a lot deeper and connect with relatives, some of whom I had never met, to get their take on the history. And so that was really cool because through the miracle of the internet, I was able to, sometimes even remember just little tidbits of names, but I knew where they lived and stuff like that, and so I was able to connect with people. Like I have this, a distant cousin, and I found him on Facebook, and so I reached out to him, and I said, hey, do you know, are you so-and-so? And he said, yes, and I said, can I, you know, call you? He said, yes, and so we had a series of conversations, which were really cool. He kind of filled me in on my grandmother on my maternal side. I had conversations with other cousins about, you know, relatives on both sides, and anyway, it was really a great chance to connect, and I had many of them tell me that they really appreciated that I had contacted them because it got them thinking about their own past also, and they turned on the light bulbs to remember their own childhoods, and we all learned that we were kind of more similar than we knew. So I'll go first with my mother. My mother's heritage, she was a German Mennonite. She was the youngest of four surviving children. A couple of the kids died in childhood. The family lived on the outskirts of Reedley, California. I never knew my maternal grandparents. They died long before I was born. But I did know that my grandmother and my grandfather were not happy campers. My mother told me that the only time she ever saw her parents have any affection was one time she saw them hold hands when they were at a funeral in their later years. The pictures I've seen of my grandparents, they were very, very stern. So they had a small farm, but money was always tight, which was another thread that I discovered running through this family history diagram, just kind of the relationship to finances and stuff, relationship to depression, relationship to addictions. I mean, it was just really multifaceted, what this taught me. So money was always tight. My aunt, my mother's sister, her name was Iona, and she was my mother's older sister. She had left home at the age of 13 to work in a wealthy couple's home to cook and clean, and she earned money there to help my mother, who was the baby of the family, they called her Babe, buy school clothes and things like that, and also to leave one less mouth to feed in the family. Iona became my mom's support system all her life. My grandfather evidently liked to gamble, and he was very abusive to my grandmother. One cousin told me he remembers my grandmother being slightly off, and upon reflection, he believed she suffered from depression. So this was another family member that now I hear about from depression. I also suffer from depression. He told me that one time my grandfather was so scared of my grandfather that she stood in the middle of the kitchen floor and just peed. Just was so scared of my grandfather. So I can only guess, you know. Anyway, my mother left home after high school graduation to join the WACS. I believe this is... It's either the WAX or the WAVES. I don't remember, but she was in the women's branch of the military. But unfortunately, she got discharged because she got pregnant. This was a family secret. I didn't hear about this until much later. She came home then to California, and she had the baby, my oldest brother, Paul, but the father did not or could not marry her. That was a real bad rejection for my mom. And I was told by other relatives that my brother Paul's father came from a wealthy Connecticut family, who, upon hearing that their son had hooked up with this kind of poor girl from California, they just couldn't support such a union. And so he wrote my mom a Dear John letter, and, you know, that was the end of that. But my mom, she always grieved that. But anyway, she came back to Reedley. She was still a young woman, you know, with a child now. And she started going to Reedley College, community college. And there she met my father, Cecil. So anyway... my father was the alcoholic. I learned through this family history diagram that I always knew that he had a brother named Stanley who he loved, but I didn't know that my father probably was suffering PTSD, definitely was a witness to great trauma. He saw his brother getting killed. And so Stanley was 10 years old. My dad was 14 at the time. Stanley was riding a horse that was unbroken, that nobody was supposed to ride, but he begged and begged, and so he was put on the horse, and the horse threw him and stomped him. And not only my father, but a whole group of cousins saw this, and I was told then by relatives that all the boys that witnessed that, I mean, they had terrible flashbacks. I mean, it was bad. It was really bad. So my brother, father, I mean, my father was 14. I believe that he started drinking as a teenager not long after that. I also learned from this family diagram that both his father and then his grandfather, so my great-grandfather, they were drinkers. I didn't know that at all. I only got to know my grandfather, my father's dad, a little bit. I met him. My mom was so resentful of that side of the family that she, because they went on to divorce, that she kept me. I didn't know any of those relatives. So anyway, I did get to know my grandfather a little bit when I was a teenager, and I would have never known about his alcoholism because at the time I met him, he had given up drinking and he was a Masonic Lodge member and stuff like that. So anyway, like I said, this diagram led me to all these family secrets and stuff. So my grandfather also beat my father, and his sister, my Aunt Dorothy, told me that he just had such a terrible temper, and that she never got beaten, but her mother would protect her and take her and put her into a closet so she didn't have to hear the beatings that my father endured, you know. So that's pretty dang bad, you know. Anyway, so these are the people that got together and tried to have a family. So they were married for 11 years. During that time, they had two boys, my two older brothers, and then me. I was conceived during the time their marriage was breaking up. Their marriage was characterized by screaming and fights and chaos. And I mean every single day. When I was then, they were divorced when I was a little girl. And at that time there was, you know, she didn't have a husband anymore, but she could yell at her kids, and there was fights every single day. Anyway, so my mother was resentful and took every opportunity to tell us how horrible he was and how bad her children were. She told me when I was just a little girl that I had a yellow streak down the middle of my back, which, you know, like my father was. She was a terrible codependent. And that's being kind. I think she was more on the narcissism spectrum. she had very low self-esteem and was a rager. After my father left, my mother met another man and then had my youngest brother, Stephen. My father then, when he left, he went on to marry another woman, and that woman was an alcoholic. They lived about 2 hours away from us, but I only remember visiting a handful of times. He didn't really participate in my life, except my mom would put me on a Greyhound bus when I was that small. And I would go down and visit him maybe once or twice a year. And during those visits, when he was off work, he would drink. And he took me along on those drinking outings. We'd go to the airport, and he liked to watch planes land and take off. And so in the car, he could sit and drink and have me along, and then he would like to go for long drives in the country and just kind of look at the agriculture and stuff like that. But he was always drinking. And I remember one time being really, really scared. He got pulled over by the cops. But he was a very charming man. And he could talk his way out of pretty much anything. Anyway, so we didn't get a ticket. I don't know why. He would take me to bars and perch me on the chair, and while he drank, and buy me a Shirley Temple. I actually thought that was so cool. Anyway, in hindsight, you know, it wasn't really a good way to spend time with your daughter that you saw maybe once or twice a year. Anyway, So I'll just kind of, I had more stuff about this, but I'll talk about my brothers. So my two other brothers, by the time they were teenagers, they had gotten into drugs. And they had petty crimes that led to juvenile hall, and then heroin led them to prison. So anyway, they were running pretty hard and just in with bad news. I remember finding drug paraphernalia hidden all throughout all the house. Everyone in the house was literally trying to find a way out. That song by Johnny Lee, "Looking for Love in All the Wrong Places," it comes to mind. When I was preparing for this, I tossed that out with my sponsor, and it was just like, that's so right, you know? Anyway, everybody was just trying to make it through the night. Everybody was just trying to make it, and we were all outward directed, like, get the hell out of that house, you know, just do anything, be it drugs, be it booze, be it other people, whatever, just get us the hell away out of that house. I grew up never feeling enough. Was told by my mother that it was a burden, what a burden all of us children were. When I was 10, my mother told me that she had always wanted a daughter, and what a disappointment I turned out to be. If I mopped the floor from right to left, I was supposed to mop it from north to south. If I didn't want to dust furniture on a Saturday morning, she would compare me to other fictional children who she told me that they would say, "Sure, Mom, I'll help you." But I didn't say that. She told me I was going to land a juvenile hall just like my brothers. But I was a freaking good girl Girl Scout. She played the victim role so well and made us truly believe we were awful children. So I still believe I'm awful. It was a shaming household, and I have carried that shame with me my whole life. I'll skip some of this. Let's see. So my dad, due to a lack of money, the only family trips of any distance we took were to various prisons around the state to visit my brothers who were incarcerated. So I learned how to drive by driving to various prisons, because my mom didn't really got anxiety in the mountains and stuff like that. So I learned to drive when I was 15 by driving in the mountains. That was exciting. Anyway, and about that time, about 15, my father then started to come and visit us every once in a while, because his second marriage was ending with his wife. I know that my mom harbored hopes of getting back together with my dad. I don't know what my dad thought. I can't ever really remember having a conversation with him. Ever. I knew he was still drinking. I found booze bottles squirreled away in the garage after he had come for a visit. But I was really grasping for straws, and I told him I really needed to get out of the house from Mom. So he suggested we get an apartment together, or I suggested, I don't know how it happened, but anyway, we even went to look at apartments, and I thought maybe that would happen, but just like my brothers knew, my dad could never deliver on promises, and so I realized that that wasn't ever going to happen. And then my mom later blamed me for ruining the chances of love again by interfering with the relationship with my father. So he was killed a couple of months later in a car accident. So I graduated from high school and I went to college. I was the first one in my family to do so. I paid my own way using money from the Social Security death benefit and from part-time jobs that I had. I knew I wanted to go to a university because I wanted a four-year degree for the career I was interested in. My mother did not support this goal. I don't know if she was jealous or was just hurt. She told me that I was too haughty and that, why wasn't a community college good enough for me? Anyway, I'm glad that I didn't listen to her. I was kind of rebellious. I knew that I wanted to get an education. It was the most important thing for me. I knew I had to get an education so that I could get out and support myself and have what I didn't have in my family as far as financial security. So that was like big for me. So I met my husband of 33 years while I was still in high school. I am grateful that I met him because using the tools that I, or the kind of person that I was then, he was what I needed. I needed somebody to get me out of that frickin' house. I needed somebody that was interested in education, that had similar financial goals than me, and things like that. And he was that person. The problem was that we both were so immature, and we both suffered from codependency. We fought, like, really bad from the time I was 18 until I left him. And that was 33 years. We could never lay down our swords, even though we went to numerous marriage counselors and things like that. Anyway, I made him my God. I just didn't know about codependency. I didn't know the roots of it. I didn't know anything like that. I was just trying to survive. I was trying to raise a family. I was trying to build a career, and I just wasn't aware. And I brought in all kinds of controlling issues into our marriage and all those things that I solely take responsibility for. I just freaking didn't know how much of a victimizer I was, and then what happened to me and how I was a victim. I just didn't even know. The unlearning has been one of the most profound and difficult tasks I have ever taken on. The tools I formerly used to ease my anxious mind were validation from the outside. If somebody else thought I was okay, then I was okay. When I left my husband, I fell into a deep depression. I had crossed bridges with him that I knew should never have crossed. He had crossed bridges with me that should have never been crossed. I was deeply ashamed of myself, but at the same time, I knew I couldn't go back to being the same person I had before because I really didn't like myself. I knew that much. I did not like myself. And I knew that he hadn't really changed. And so through ACA, I came to know that the only person I can change is me. The tools I use, well, actually, I want to take some time and read something that I found today. It was the True Parent Calls. So this is from, the Big Red Book, page 199. The True Parent Calls. Every adult child has unexpressed grief, which is usually represented by the symptoms of depression, lethargy, or forms of disassociation. The grief that we speak of is the ACA cumulative loss of childhood. Grief is loss that is stuck beneath denial, willful forgetting, and the fear of being perceived as dramatizing the past. Grief is built up defects, slights, and neglect from childhood. We carry this grief with us as we create careers, raise families, or trudge through life as best as we can. The losses we speak of in ACA include the actions and inactions of our parents or family. Being shamed by our parents or a relative represents loss of being able to feel whole as a person. Shame tramples a child's natural love and trust and replaces it with malignant self-doubt. With shame, we lose our ability to trust ourselves or others. We feel inherently faulty as a child. Longtime ACA members understand the importance of claiming grief or loss. Grief work restores the power of tears. We find out that emotional pain can be the gateway to a closer connection with God as we understand God. After making it through, we feel changed. We embrace the inner strength we have always had, and we see emotional pain in a new light. We see it as one instrument which can temper our diamond-hard survival traits. By facing our pain, we learn that we really are not alone in our suffering. We find ourselves in this kind of pain, we stay close to meetings and keep our faces turned towards God as we understand God. And that is what I'm doing. I'm doing the difficult job of grieving now. When I was preparing this talk, I was grieving my childhood a lot. I felt like crap all day yesterday when I was preparing this, and I have to now give myself that time to do that and just to stand in my own pain and not be fearful of my own pain. I don't need to distract myself from that. I don't need to do all those millions of things that I used to do. The biggest one was distraction with another person because I was a codependent. I don't need to do that. I can be a big girl now. I can stand in my own pain and I can feel that and I can let it flow through me and I am still okay and I'm stronger. I'm really stronger because of that. So, the other tools that I use to move through this, to move through trying to be on the other side a person that I'm really proud of, I use art a lot now. I've taken up painting. I love to paint. I did a painting this morning. I like it. It's fun. I color on now road trips. Whenever somebody else is driving, I bring along an adult coloring book and beautiful, you know, rich colors and stuff like that, and I'll color. I use meditation almost daily. I pray almost daily. I listen to podcasts by kind of spiritual people. I attend church. I really like being part of Unity. I found a congregation in Santa Maria and also in Aurora Grande that I like, and so I kind of vacillate between the two. I am good to myself as far as exercise. I'm good to myself by allowing me to slow down. All my life, I just was like multitasking to the nth degree. I had a career that we were so praised for multitasking. And in addition to that, I mean, at home, I could do 14 things at once and just kind of create chaos if somebody else didn't follow my freaking plan, you know? That was crazy. I've slowed down. I'm a lot quieter now. Patience was something I never had before. I remember when I had my first child, I have two kids, that a friend said, "Oh, children will bring you more patience." That was not true for me. But meditation in this program has brought me more patience. So, I'm trying new things all the time. Right now I'm hosting two foreign students from Spain, and I love to travel. Couldn't travel, this year, so, I brought Europe to me. I like that. I'm just kind of doing new things all the time. I know I'm finding my true self finally. I tell myself little affirmations all the time, such as progress, not perfection. I do this sometimes when I'm working in the garden pulling weeds. There will always be more weeds, but it doesn't all have to be done today. This is new for me, coming from this former, you know, blitzing, I have to do it now, I have to do it all, you know, and only stopping when I was dead tired. I don't anymore. I'm learning just to let things go. The art of life. It's a new thing for me. Thank you so much for listening and being part of my healing. Thank you.